The old plumber was quite a character too. I remember called out to an emergency one time, got the tools and were walking along the passageway where this pipe was leaking. And he put his hand up along where it was dripping. And he said, "Oh, that's it. Third class ladies' toilets." Oh, he was a character. And another occasion, with so many troops on board, they had to fit extra toilets, and these were just long benches with a hole in the top and in rows. Now, quite frequently we got blocked toilets, and most often the cause was the Air Force and a lot of the troops were issued with forage caps, you know, like chip bag caps, they used to call them, slim caps. And more often than not, when the ship was in the tropics, these fellas never wore them, and they used to fit them in, tuck them into their belts around their waist. Then they go to the toilet and forget all about the forage cap, undo their belts, and the forage cap would drop down into the toilet and block the toilet. Well, one day we got called out to a blocked toilet, and I went with them, and we got there, and it was blocked right up to the top. Oh, it was a right stinking mess. I remember we were in the tropics in the Indian Ocean. So he said, "Okay, you clear it." So I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Roll your sleeve up and put your hand in." He said, "It'll be a forage cap. All you got to do is pull the forage cap out." So I said, "No fear." I said, "I'm not putting my hand in that mess. I'm not going to put my hand in there." So he lost his temper a bit, and he rolled his sleeve up, and he put his arm in almost up to his shoulder. Ooh, my stomach was turning. Anyway, eventually he pulled his hand out, and it was a wallet. And he opened this wallet. There was no name or address in it, and there was about £50 in it. And that, in those days, that was a lot of money. So he says, "There, see what you missed?" I said, "Blimey, next time I'll put me head in." He washed the money and that, and there was no one to address or name on it. So he says, "I'm going to keep that." He said, "Hand that in." He says, "Anybody could say it was theirs." So he got about £50 for putting his hand in the toilet. So we went through the Suez Canal, and the first night after we got through the canal, it was just coming dusk, about 8 o'clock at night, when a submarine surfaced just astern of us. As dusk was falling, the submarine appeared astern, and before darkness came, it seemed as if she was catching up on us, so the sirens went, action stations, everybody rushing around putting their life jackets on, and orders for full steam ahead was given, and the old ship started going quite some speed, but she was bouncing and bobbing about, and there was plates, jumbling thing, was, the whole ship was shaking, there was crockery was bouncing about, and next thing there was, I got word to go to the plumber that there were pipes bursting. So I went to see the old plumber at the plumber's shop there, and he told me what tools to put in the bag. He said there's a steam pipe gone at the top of the funnel, up at the top of the funnel, he said, and hot water's coming down, he says, and spitting on the blokes down below there. He says, come on, we'll have to get onto it. So I followed him, and caused the heat in the Red Sea. Terrific, the heat there, you know. So I followed him, and he started. He went ahead of me up the ladder, up the funnel. And I followed it behind him with the... It was like a canvas tool bag, an open type bag that plumbers usually use with two big handles on. I put the handles over my shoulder and climbed up this ladder behind him. The metal ladder was hot. Anyway, we got right up, and on the top of these big liners, the funnels are quite tall, you know. It was the old, she was an old-fashioned, an old ship, as I've explained, which used to have tall funnels. So I followed up. Of course, the hot water was coming down on top of us as we were going up, hitting us and then bouncing off. We got there, and he was shouting down below, told me, by now it was dark, what you call it, what tools he wanted, and I was feeling in the bag. It was just the moonlight and the stars above. It couldn't shine a torch in case that somebody torpedoed us, so it was all by feel what tools he asked for and passed them to. We were up there quite a long time. The sweat was absolutely pouring off me. I was soaked. My dungarees and everything, my feet, everything was soaked, and the heat on holding onto the ladders was terrible. Eventually, we said the job was done. Let's get down out of here. So we set off down. And as I say, the whole ship was shaking and bouncing about. We got down on the deck there, and he seemed to be very thin, he was, but he was as tough as old iron. We went back to the plumber's shop, put the tools away, and he said, better get near your boat stations. So he went off, and I went back to the cabin to get me life jacket, and I passed out. And the next thing I knew, it was next day, late on next day, I woke up, and there was one of these priests standing by the bedside reading the last rites. I wonder where on earth I was, and was I in heaven or what? Anyway, I come round and everything. The ship's doctor came to see me, and it was all right. And then Philip Bridgen called, coming to see me, and he told me what the next morning, the submarine was almost alongside, and it turned out it was an Italian submarine, and they were wanting to surrender. So they were flying the white flag. So quite a few of these naval chaps we were carrying on board, they put a boat down, and these naval chaps went over to her and boarded her, and they took some of their crew off and sent them back to our ship as prisoners, and the Orduna escorted her, and we went into Mombasa and took the submarine into Mombasa. But I never felt so ill in my life before. It turned out I had pleurisy, they told me, but whatever it was or not, I don't know. But Philip Bridgen had stopped smoking, and I was gasping for a smoke. I kept asking when people were passing me a cigarette out of my locker, and I was coughing. Like in the finish, I said to Philip, "Oh, take those cigarettes, you take them, Philip." So he took them, and he started smoking again. However, we put this submarine into Mombasa, and I think it was the Wrens got off there, and then we set off for Durban. And we arrived in Durban, and when you tied up these big passenger boats, there was a woman there. I forget her name. I have heard her name mentioned. She wore a big white hat. And every troop ship that tied up in Durban, she used to go stand up in some boxes and sing to the troops. She had a very good voice too, and she, you could hear her voice for miles. And she sang to every troop ship that came into Durban. I can't recall what her name was. But she was there. Well, we had quite a few days in Durban. And Philip Bryson wandered off from the ship. It turned out, after when he turned back on board, he had some relatives lived in Durban. And he'd gone off to see them. Not a word to anyone. Well, I often thought he could have taken me round. But the strange thing happened. I went ashore and I went into a big cinema there. And I was sitting in the cinema on my own. But it was all different troops and that there. Of course, it was apartheid then. Only whites were allowed in. But I was sitting there and the film had started, and one of these coloured attendants came behind me and tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "Excuse me, sir." He said, "Someone wants to see you." So I said, "Where?" He said, "In the foyer." So I followed this bloke to the foyer, and I couldn't see anybody I knew. The only person there was a South African sailor, South African Navy uniform. So I said to this coloured attendant, who is it looking for me? So he pointed him to this South African sailor. So I went over, and this chap said, he says, "You're Arthur Adams. Your name's Arthur Adams, isn't it?" And I said, "That's right." He said, "You live in Douglas, don't you?" I said, "That, yes." He said, "In the main road." So I said, "Yeah." He said, "How do you know me?" He said, "Well, I've seen you singing in concerts and that on the island." I said, "Well, who are you then?" He says, "Well, I'm from the, I'm Manx," he said. He said, "My name is Roberts." So I said, "Well, what are you doing in South African uniform then?" So he told me a story then. He'd been called up into the army and done his training and then put on a troop ship, and he was bound for Burma and the Far East. And when the ship put into Durban, he done a bunk, he deserted. And he said he was frightened to write home in case they traced him. He was only about 18. Well, he'd be about 19, he'd be called up when he was 18, so by then he'd be about 19. So he said, and he was awful homesick, he wanted to get home, and he didn't know what to do. So he said, "Are you on a merchant ship?" So I told him, "Yes, I'm on a Yarduna, we're tied up here." So he said, "Do you think, could you smuggle me aboard and get me home?" So I said, "Oh no, I couldn't do anything like that." I said, So he said, "Are there any other Manxmen aboard?" So I told him Philip Bryson. I said, "But he, when I left the ship, he hadn't been there for a couple of days." So he told me his mother's name was Bryson before she married. She'd been a barmaid in, I'm not sure it was the New Strand Inn or the Old Strand Inn in Strand Street in Douglas. So I said, "Can I come back on board the ship with you?" So I took him back on board to have a drink and have a chat with him. When I got back, Philip Bryson had turned up, so he started on again, this lad, could you smuggle me home? So Philip Bryson saying, "Oh, I'm having..." And I said, "No." So I said, "The best thing you can do is give yourself up." So he said, "Oh, I couldn't do that." So I said, in the finish, I said, "Well, if I come with you, and tell them I know you, and, you know, speak up for you. Will you give yourself up? So eventually he agreed to do that, and I went to a police station with him, and he gave himself up. His name was Roberts. I did meet him again after the war, but I felt sorry for him at the time, but we couldn't take a chance on smuggling him. Or we never, it would never have got through with it, you know. Such is life, eh? Anyway, we set off back home, sailed on our own up to Freetown. Then we got a convoy home to Liverpool, but the ship paid off. So, of course, as I mentioned earlier in the tape, Manx boats left Fleetwood at that point in the war. So Philip Brides and I, we went and put our luggage into the left luggage office at the exchange station. And I was stupid. He said, oh, let's put them to save time. Let's put them all on the one ticket. So we put all our bags and cases into the left luggage on one ticket, and he kept the ticket. So we promised to meet some of the crew that we'd made friends with in the pub up in Lime Street called The Legs of Man that night. So we turned up there and we were having drinks. And then come about 9 o'clock, or perhaps a bit later, near the closing time, and one of these fellows said, where's Brideson gone? Have you seen him, sir? I said, no, sir. A couple of them went looking for him in the toilets and the other bar to come. He's not here. So I thought, blimey. What can I do, sir? I went round a couple of the places where seamen's homes, where you could get a bed for the night, to see if he'd booked in anywhere. But he hadn't. I couldn't find him, so eventually I booked myself in the sailor's home and slept the night there. So I had to get up early in the morning because the train left Exchange Station at 8:30 in the morning. So I got up early, looked around to see if he'd went to the office to see if he'd booked in after me, but he hadn't. So I got down to the station about 8:10. So I waited till about 20 past, and he never turned up. So I went to the left luggage department and I said, could I have my bags, please? So the chap says, where is your ticket? So I said, well, my pal's got my ticket. I've lost him. He hasn't turned up. So he says, oh, I haven't got a ticket. I can't give you your bags. By this time, the train was in the station for Fleetwood. So I could see my bags. I knew them and I said, they are there. Those are my bags, I said. My name is on them. And I got my discharge book and my identity card out. And I said, there's my identity. Can't I have them, please? He said, I'm sorry, no ticket, no bags. So about 3 minutes from 8:30, Philip Brideson comes walking in through the gates, taking all the time in the world. So I ran and got hold of him by the arm. I said, come on, quick, the train's going in a couple of minutes. He gets the ticket out, we get the bags and run up, throw them on. Just got in, the door shut and the train was off. And we got the bags settled and sat in the seat. I said, where the bloody hell did you go, Philip? I said, I've been worried all night. And I thought I was going to lose my bags then. He said, oh, I just remembered. I've got an auntie in Hoylake on the Whittle, he said, and I hadn't seen them for a long time, so I thought I'd just slip and see them, and then they asked me to stay the night. I said, blimey, you could have told me. As I say, that's the guy he was. Well, eventually we got home and enjoyed another leave. Every leave I had from the Merchant Navy, I used to go round to see the taxi driver who'd taken me for the Big Fiddle, Billy Farragher. I'd got very, very friendly with him, and he was a lovely chap, one of the nicest chaps I ever met in my life. Very quiet, and he loved a joke, but with his tired heart, he was only about 34 when he died. But I used to go round to his home in Christian Road. His mother, she'd remarried, her name was Trimble there. She lived there with her second husband, and she had a couple of daughters living in the house with her too, to her second husband, Sheila and Greba. They were named Trimble. And I had many happy nights there, going round to their house. They used to get me to recite monologues and do a bit of a song and a dance and impressions to keep Billy happy. And I used to love doing it for him because, as I say, he was a lovely chap. And they took visitors in lodges. So there was always quite a few people in that house. A very happy home it was. And it was around this time that I met a girl. I went to school with her brother, Harry Brown. He'd been in the church choir with me, and I'd known her in St. Matthew's Church, the Sunday school. So I started going out with her, with Barbara. She was working as a barmaid at the Seton Hotel. And she lived with her father and mother in Pull Rose, just outside Douglas Hall. I'd wait until the hotel closed and walk home with her. And on Sunday nights, we used to go to the cinema together, and on a night off, we'd go to the movies together, and I got very friendly with her. But that was the only trip I ever done with Philip Bryson. He said about getting another ship together, and I said, oh, I don't think so, Philip, I don't think so. I was home for Christmas on that leave, and then we had a bit of tragedy. Christmas Day, my sister Winnie, she received a telegram to say that her eldest son, Harry Keeley, he'd only been 19 then, he was in the RAF, he was a bomb aimer, and he'd been shot down and killed over a raid over Berlin on Christmas Eve. So that put a damper on the Christmas. When he took it very bad, he's been quite a clever lad. He'd gone to high school, and then from there on he went to Cambridge University. Then he got called up, and in such a short time he was killed. Buried in a British war grave in Berlin. So my sister took it really bad. I'd done all I could to comfort her. So she was left with the other son, who was still a young schoolboy. And the husband, his regiment had been transferred from the King's Liverpool Regiment to the Cheshire Regiment, and they'd left the Isle of Man to guard prisoners in England. And then, even though all the men in the regiment were in their 40s or so, they'd been sent out to Italy to guard prisoners in Italy. So I had to send him a telegram and let him know. Winnie had a few lodgers staying with her at the time, so it helped keep her company. There was a man and his wife. He worked for Boosey and Hawkes, the musical instrument factory in London, and he was over doing something at one of the cinemas, the sound systems or something. George Bent, his name was, and his wife Phyllis. They're a nice couple. I made good friends with them. And she also had a couple of soldiers and their wives, men who were stationed at the officers training depot, guarding there, so she had a bit of company. My leave come to an end, and I had to cross to Liverpool. I reported back to the Merchant Navy Pool, I think it was the 15th or 16th of January 1944. There was no boats in that followed me for a day or so. Well, eventually I got sent to join a ship at in the docks at Birkenhead on the 19th of January. So I travelled over with a few chaps from the pool. When we eventually got to the docks to join the ship, it was called the Empire Alliance. We found it was a tanker belonging to Shell Mex, Shell Oil. So it was a brand new ship. So we joined this ship, and while we when we arrived there, there was the ship had been fitted with six big high booms, very high. They were taller than the masts. There were six of them, two up at the front end forward and two amidships and two down aft. And apparently these booms, the idea of them was, we discovered that when you got in dangerous waters, these booms were lowered so they hung out from the ship horizontally, and attached to these booms were big steel nets. The idea was if a U-boat or an airplane fired torpedoes at you, you could catch these torpedoes in the nets. I'd never seen these before, but that's what they were fitting out. So I got aboard and found the accommodation. It was beautiful accommodation to what I'd had previously. There was two men to a cabin, no more than two men in each cabin. So it was much homelier and a bit more privacy. I signed on as a fireman greaser. So one of the chaps who'd come down from the pool with me was a Liverpool chap himself, roughly about the same age as me. His name was Harry Fowler. So I got sorted out with the cabin with Harry. And the mess, a beautiful mess room. And of course on tankers, you're not allowed to smoke in your cabin or anywhere else on the ship except aft, or that's aft means behind the funnel. So up on the top deck of the poop at the stern of the ship, there was a special room for smoking there, a smoke room. So you could only smoke there, or if you're on deck, you could only smoke right at the stern. So there was no chance of sparks getting near the cargo, which of course was common sense. And I learned that the common thing with men on tankers, they didn't smoke proper cigarettes. They used to get tobacco and roll your own cigarettes. So I very soon became initiated into this type of smoking. The idea being, normal cigarettes, put them down anywhere, even in an ashtray, they burn away, and there's chance of them being knocked over and that. When you rolled your own cigarettes, don't ask me why, I don't know, they never burned away. If you put them down in an ashtray, they would just go out. They never burned away. There was something in the tobacco. Saltpeter, I think, some of the chaps mentioned. So they were much safer to smoke than ordinary cigarette, so everybody on board used to smoke. The common name, the nickname for it, was Tickler. Used to get it in 2 ounce tins. And you could buy the cigarette papers. So, we'd only been on a few hours when we found out that all the fresh water on the ship had to be pumped up by hand from a main tank. Now, up on the top of the poop deck, that's down aft, just outside the smoking room that I just mentioned, on the bulkhead or wall, as people ashore call it, was this little tiny pump about the size of a banjo. And that was the name of what they called these pumps, banjo pumps. They were shaped like a banjo, the round part of the banjo, and a wooden handle fitted to it at the top end of the. So you had to hold this handle with both hands and work it sideways, left and right, left and right. The length of the handle would only be about 14 or 15 inches. So you can guess how long it took with this little pump to pump water up from the bottom of the ship up into tanks, one at the galley, one in the crew's accommodation, and one in the officer's accommodation. Now on tankers, you have the front end of the ship, which is the forecastle head, and then you have the open deck where all the tanks are there. The tanks have lids on top of them, round lids, and then in halfway along is what they call the centre castle. Now on the main deck of that accommodation, the officers lived, the mates and the engineers, and above that, and also their dining saloon. And above that was further accommodation for the radio operator and the deck officers. And then just above that was the captain's cabin and the bridge. And on top of that was what was called the Monkey Island. And then there's another open deck behind that, and you have the poop deck, where the entrance to the engine room was, and the crew, the ordinary ratings, firemen, seamen and stewards and the cooks, they all lived there. And on the main deck was the galley where the cook cooked all the meals. Now connecting the poop deck to the centre castle was like a bridge. And there was also a bridge running from the centre castle to the forecastle at the front. Because when tankers are loaded, they go very low in the water. And in bad weather, the seas rush right across the main deck. So to get from one part of the ship to the other, you had to walk along this flying bridge, as it was called. And all the meals for the officers were all cooked aft in the crew's accommodation and had to be carried by stewards along the flying bridge to the amidships accommodation in the centre castle. And in bad weather, it was a dicey job running with the ship rolling and the sea spraying over. The food was all put in watertight containers, one on top of the other. But the steward who had to carry them had to watch for the weather when the ship was going to dip and the sea come over. Otherwise, a chance you'd be washed over. So they're different to any other type of ship I'd been on. Now, this pump for pumping this water was a bone of contention. We were told that two men had to take it in turns pumping it up, and you had to do a week's spell. Two firemen greasers done it for a week, and then the following week two sailors had to do the pumping. The stewards weren't required to do it for some reason. Now this Harry Fowler, who I shared the accommodation with, he turned out he was a communist. He wouldn't mind me telling it because he was very sincere about it. So he said, oh, we're not going to put up with this, he said, this pumping. He said, a brand new ship, it's ridiculous this being fitted. They should have a mechanical pump to pump it. So he went up to see the captain. And the captain argued with him a bit, so Harry said, okay, we'll get the Seamen's Union down. So we're still in docks. We didn't actually sail on the 19th. He nipped ashore and brought a representative from the Seamen's Union aboard, and they kicked up a row. So the captain promised he would have a mechanical pump fitted. But that wasn't done before we sailed. But Harry, I'll always remember, we had about nearly a week living on board before the ship set sail. And I used to go ashore with him. I went home with him to meet his father and mother. And a couple of times he took me to some meetings, communist meetings. I wasn't interested in communism, but I went because you got a free cup of tea and a currant bun, a couple of sandwiches, and it was amusing to go there and listen to them. He used to make me laugh, this Harry Fowler. He told me the tale, he said, about an out of work. He went up to Lord Derby's estate, like somewhere outside West Derby or somewhere. Lord Derby's estate, and he knocked on the door, and the servant came to the door, and he said, I want something to eat. So the chap told him, he said, clear off. He said, this is Lord Derby's estate. So this chap said, well, bring me Lord Derby. So the servant went and brought Lord Derby, and Lord Derby said, what the devil do you mean by coming and knocking on my door? So this chap said, well, I'm hungry. He said, you've got plenty of money, I want something to eat. So Lord Derby said to him, do you like cold rice pudding? So this fellow said, yes. So Lord Derby said, well, come back tomorrow, it's hot today. So he told me the tale. This fellow said, oh, he said, I want something to eat, he said. So Lord Derby said, no, go on, no more, just get off my land. So this chap said to him, he says, what do you mean your land? Where did you get it from? So Lord Derby said, I got it from my father. And this fellow said, well, where did he get it from? He said, he got it from his father. He says, over the years, he says, my ancestors fought for this land. So the tramp said to him, all right. He took his jacket off. He said, all right, come out in the grass there. I'll fight you for it. It makes you think, doesn't it? But we were promised that this pump would be fitted, but it wasn't. So eventually we set the sail, and we had to put up with this pumping. The tale was from the captain that there wasn't the time to get it done in the UK, and he'd have it done in America when we got there. We were bound for America. But she was, as I say, the first time I'd sailed on a tanker, and it took some getting used to the restrictions on smoking and the room to work about, walk about on deck. And also, when we left, they filled the tanks with ballast, with seawater. Otherwise it was too high out of the water, you see. So we filled up with ballast and we set sail now. With a floating cargo, liquid, the ship, even though it was on calm weather, it seemed to rock about side to side a bit. No matter how calm the weather, you still had this slight movement from side to side. But one got used to it. And this ship was to be my home for about 15 months. But I made some very good friends on it. There were some real characters on the ship. It's strange, every ship you went to, you met different characters, and there were some real good ones on it. There was one chap there, he was a naval seaman. His name was Harry Haywood, I never forgot his name. But he had a beard, a full set of beard. And he was a double of, you see, stained windows and churches of Christ and statues of Christ. Well, Harry Haywood, he was just as if he'd stepped out of a church. He was a double of the figure of Christ. No, the lads all called him Jesus. He was naval seaman. Then there was another young seaman I got friendly with, Sid Croucher. He had been in a boy's home, a boy's training ship, the Indefatigable. And also a friend of his, he'd been on the same training ship, Les Prattley. Now, and he got on everybody's nerves for a while. He was reading a book, I forget the name of the title of it, but the word hello kept coming up every other line. So in the finish, he kept saying hello to everything. You know, you would say to him, well, do you fancy a cup of tea, Les? And you, hello, cup of tea. Well, do you want a cigarette, Les? Hello, cigarette. Till he got in everybody's nerves. So they call him the hello kid. Then there was another young lad that he was a steward. Prattley was a steward, and Ben Hawked, he came from Nottingham. He was doing his first trip. A big, ruddy-faced, happy, big grin on his face all the time. But with a name like Haupt, H-A-U-P-T, everybody called him a German. Then there was another lad, I can't remember his name, but they called him K-Legs. He'd worked on a farm. It was his first trip. He came from down the south, I'm not sure if it's Oxfordshire or Wiltshire or somewhere. Chipping Norton was the name of the place he come from. You used to say to him, where do you come from, K-Legs? And he said, I be a Chippy Norton, or I be. He was a real born comedian. Then there was another chap. He'd been in the Merchant Navy and left the sea and got to work. He was working on the railways. He was about 60, grey hair. George Merry, his name was. And his son-in-law was born in on Christmas Island out in the Pacific. They'd met on ships previously, and he brought this lad home, and he eventually married George's daughter. Then there was a Swede. He had three or four gold teeth. They called him Goldie. He was a big, heavy man, a Swede. He spoke with a strong accent. He was sitting at the mess table. He'd be saying, yeah, you pass me the yam. The jam. Now then, George Merry's son-in-law, he was at the lamp trimmer, which is a petty officer on the ship. He'd been sent by the company to join the ship. Now this Swedish chap, Goldie, he'd been sent, there was a mistake, as lamp trimmer. But the captain had given the job of lamp trimmer to George Merry's son, because son-in-law, because he was the first to arrive on board. So this Swedish chap, he had it in for him right from when he joined the ship. And there was another young fellow, he'd be about 26 or 27. We never found out what his second name was. We called him Joe. Orlican Joe. That Orlican is the name of a gun. Now this lad, he was a bundle of nerves. He was shaking all the time. He'd been on quite a few convoys to Malta. and suffered quite a few air attacks. And he used to be always telling us about it. And then I shooting the gun, and he's going, making the noise of the guns. They called him Orlick and Joe. But he was very near breaking point. And then there was a galley boy, he'd been a boy from Borstal, but apparently Shell Mechs took so many boys from Borstal every year. And this galley boy, he was doing his first trip. Then there were two firemen in the same crowd with me, but they were blokes in their late 40s, and they were a pair of real comedians. The one, they called him Twin Screw Donnelly. He was always talking about the big ships he'd been on, the big liners, twin screws. He used to be on about this tanker. Oh, it's just a single screw. I'm used to a twin screw. So they called him Twin Screw Donnelly. And his friend, they called him Up and Down Job McNamee. Now, Up and Down Job is a type of steam engine, reciprocating engine, where the pistons go up and down, straight up and down, and a greaser has to put his hand out when the thing comes up and touch it to see if it'll get overheating. So everybody called him Up and Down Job McNamee. Now, they'd sailed before together, and this Donnelly had brought a birdcage on board the ship, and a celluloid canary in it. And he hung it up outside the galley, and when he's going to sit, when he knocked off for a smoke, he'd be talking to the bird and whistling to an impression of the bird. And these two, Donnelly and McNamee, they were quite characters sitting there, and they'd be talking to the bird. Oh, but a real happy crowd, that one of the happiest crowds I've ever sailed with. Another character, too, when we were waiting to sign on, the officer kept calling out for Percy Reed. Nobody knew who he was or where he was coming from. Apparently he was a steward, but